I'm going to do two parts to this talk this morning. And the reason for that is that I want to put a bit of context to the reading today. Because in today's reading, we're introduced to this thing called the Ark of the Covenant. And some of you, you know, if you've read the Bible much or been around church a lot, you might know a bit about what this thing is, the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, there's going to be a picture come up. Dan has kindly found for me. But you might not have much of an idea of what it is, or I might have read the Bible and think, oh, I don't really know what it is actually about. So I thought I'd just take a few minutes to introduce this concept. What is this all about? Because that will help us then as we look at the passage that we're going to read about today. So the Ark of the Covenant, well, let's go back a little bit. And if we go back to the time where the Israelites, God's people, escaped from Egypt. They'd been in Egypt under slavery, under Pharaoh, a captive people, this family of tribes. And under Moses' leadership, God led them out of Egypt. And he promised them a land in Canaan that would be flowing with milk and honey, a land that they could put down roots and call their own and be a people. But it was a dangerous journey to get there. Firstly, they had to contend with their pursuers, the Egyptians, who were none too happy that their entire slave workforce had sort of fled the country. Not only that, they were traveling through a desert to get there. And not only that, they were nomadic, and this was a time of war where, you know, there was plundering and invading someone's tribe or land was just like going to the corner shop. It's that sort of situation. So it was a dangerous journey. Not only that, but they were a forgetful people. So they weren't just at danger from the people around them attacking them. They were at danger from their own thoughts, their own discouragement, their own disillusionment. They were a traveling, wandering people who were surviving on just the daily bread that God gave them, this manna. And they constantly had to be called back to remember, God led you out of Egypt and he's leading you to a better place. Keep going. Don't give up. And I don't know about you, but it's hard to trust God when it feels like that, when you feel like you're just going round and round again. It's hard when you've got no visual reminder, no visible, things don't seem to be improving. And so this is where the Ark of the Covenant comes into the story. There's a moment they're camped at the bottom of Mount Sinai, and Moses is led up the mountain, and God gives him these commandments, these rules for living that would make them a fruitful and prosperous people. And he also gives them instructions to make this ark, the Ark of the Covenant. And as you can see, it's this sort of big wooden box with cherubim and poles and all sorts of stuff, and they all have their symbolic meaning. But about a year after they escaped from Egypt, they were given this box, this ark. And the ark was a reminder of God's presence with them. It was to be home to the tablets that the covenant was written on, the commandments were written on, sorry. And it was to be a symbol that God was with them and that God would go before them and be their guide. They were a traveling people, so the poles, it's about movement. They were to follow God as their guide. It's interesting because they're told never to have idols, no graven images, nothing. This is the one exception. But the difference was, while other people worshipped these objects, these golden calves or what have you, they weren't to worship this. This was to be a symbol, a reminder of their covenant relationship with God, a reminder that God was with them and would guide them. And this became the heart of their worship, Israelite worship. It was to be put in the holiest of holy places in their tent as they traveled. But over the years, we've talked about the wars and the threat that these people were under. And one of the groups that emerged as their greatest threat was a group that we've talked about in previous weeks in this little series, the Philistines. And the Philistines were a strong people. And during one particular battle, they captured the Ark of the Covenant. And they captured it and they kept it. I always just wondered, why didn't they destroy it? But I guess it was worth something. It was precious. And maybe it was useful for bartering later on. But they captured the ark. But the ark turned out to be a bit of a poison chalice for the Philistines. And things started to go wrong for them because they had this thing. And they were like, oh, this is terrible. We don't want this. Let's give it them back. So they gave the ark back to the Israelites. But they didn't really know what to do with it. Saul became king, as we've talked about. And Saul just didn't know how to handle this thing, the ark. And he didn't treat it with the reverence it deserved. He didn't consult God when he was going into battle. And God said that Saul would no longer be king and that David would be. So when David comes to power as the king of Israel, they've had the ark for a number of years, and it's been kept in the home of a man called Obed-Edom, which I really, really like that name, Obed-Edom. Maybe consider that for if we have another child, Obed-Edom. and it's been in this house, but David, being the king that he was and being the worshipping man that he was, he wanted the ark to be right back at the heart of Israelite worship. And when David captured the city of Jerusalem, which was kind of in the middle of the northern and southern kingdoms of Judah and Israel, he wanted to bring the ark into his capital, make it the heart once again of Israelite worship and of their identity, a reminder that God was with them. And so this is where we take up the story today, and where we take up our reading, with the ark being brought back to Jerusalem.
So we're going to read from 2 Samuel, chapter 6, verse 12 to 23, page 310 in this church Bible, if you want to read looking down or looking up. Hopefully it'll appear above me. 2 Samuel 6, 12. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God." So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David, with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes, but by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death.
Fantastic. Thanks, Miranda. When I read that passage, I realise how unlike David I am. Because I don't know about you, but I don't enjoy looking silly at all. I've quite a low embarrassment threshold, really, which I definitely get from my dad. Though, actually, when I think about that, I think probably Amy would probably think that I'm actually quite embarrassing. So I've got this low embarrassment threshold, but I realise that I can be quite embarrassing. And I know I'm going to embarrass Joshua a lot. I've already got plans for that. This reminds me, it makes me think back to my childhood. And I, in my sort of younger years, my early teen years, I developed a real phobia for dancing. And I think it was the first time I went to a school disco. It was my first year at high school. And I went to the school disco that happened. I remember stepping onto the dance floor and just being standing there thinking, right, what do I do now? And my body just didn't know how to move to the rhythm of the beat, you know. I didn't have it in me to dance. And I tried something and that was it. My confidence was completely gone. All these other people were dancing and having a good time. And I left and I walked out and I went down the corridor. And I just remember feeling so awkward and embarrassed. And that plagued me for years and years and years. I just couldn't ever step onto a dance floor. I'm a bit better now, but I still find it a real challenge to do that. I don't like looking silly. I don't like feeling undignified. I don't know whether for you there are things that you would be prepared to look foolish for, or people that you'd be prepared to look undignified for. I think there are a lot of things in life that people will do that for that you wouldn't imagine. I remember going to a football match with someone I worked with in a high school. He was the assistant head of this high school that I worked at, and he was a mad Burnley fan, a season ticket holder at the club. A really respectable chap, you know, very professional, very together, very level-headed. And I just couldn't believe it. We were sat at this football match, and he was on his feet, and he was shouting at the referee, and I was really embarrassed sitting next to him. He was so undignified. Just his passion for his football team called out this undignified, unashamed praise of his team and wanting to slate the others. And I think the same is true of lots of things in life. I've been to other discos or weddings or whatever it might be, and just friends of mine that I've never been in that situation with step onto a dance floor and just go for it. Let themselves go, and I think, wow, where did that come from? I didn't know that was in you. I've never seen you like this before. Just the love of music and passion for dancing. Or maybe the love of your life. You know, I've seen people on social media write the most gushing prose to their loved one in a kind of out there, undignified way. Or crazy proposals happening in public, just a public display of affection. And I just think there are lots of things in life that in most areas you may be the most dignified, professional, level-headed person, but there may be something that just calls this response out of you. And I know a lot of people that will do foolish things for God as acts of worship or devotion, whether that's... And when I say worship this morning, you know, we're talking about David, and David was worshipping by dancing before the Lord. He danced with all his might, it said. He was twirling and whirling and doing all sorts of things. But when we talk about worship, we're talking about all sorts of things. It may be singing, it may be dancing, but it may be giving. It may be fasting or praying or anything that's an act of worship or devotion to God. And I know people that have given up all sorts of things for God, giving up well-paid careers to live on very little as a worship, an act of worship to God, giving up a comfortable lifestyle, or people who have moved to dangerous or isolating places. I remember when I worked at Woody's, there was a girl there who's a partner of the church, and she felt the call to move to this tiny remote island in the Indian Ocean. She wasn't allowed to say where exactly it was. It was a majority Muslim nation, in fact, 99%. And it was quite actually dangerous for her to be there as a single Christian woman. And she certainly wasn't allowed to talk about her faith, but she was there just to share the love of God. She felt called there to be salt and light. And in fact, some of my sister-in-law's family have recently moved to India, to a city where there are no other Christians. But they've gone there with their little family, tiny children, a family of five of them, just moved out there to be God's salt and light in that city. And people will even lay down their lives as an act of worship and devotion. And these things that seem perfectly reasonable often to people who have found faith in God, who have that called out of them, but look like complete foolishness to others. And worship can look foolish, can't it? And even in, as in today's story, quite undignified. We've read that as it returned to Jerusalem, David danced with all his might, and his wife comes out and she despises him for it. She doesn't understand. She's not had that heart response to God. And she says, how you've distinguished yourself today. In other words, he's taken off his kingly robes. This wasn't becoming of a king what he was doing. This wasn't how someone should behave in his position. And for me, this story raises some issues about worship, about what is at the heart of worship. When appearances and styles and roles are all stripped away, what is worship about? What drew such an undignified, extravagant response from David? And I'm just going to highlight three things that spoke to me from this passage today about worship. I think the first thing is that worship is an act of relationship. The ark was much more than a religious symbol, and worship was much more than a ritual. The ark symbolized something much more. It was a reminder that God, the living God, was actually with his people. The one who had acted in their lives, rescued them from slavery, was present with them. And that truth was crucial to Israel's whole existence. It's kind of like, well, if this isn't about a living relationship with a living God, what are we even doing? What do we exist for as a people? And that's true for us. You know, if we gather and God isn't in our midst and God isn't present and this isn't about a relationship, what are we doing? And worship can all too easily become ritualistic and boring and impersonal. But I think for me, this passage highlights that at the heart of worship is a relationship with the living God. The second thing I think is that, and this is really interesting, that what David says here, but it's clear that for him, worship is for the audience of one. It's for God's eyes only. He says, it was before the Lord, he says to his wife, it was before the Lord. I will celebrate before the Lord. And I don't know about you, but I have these moments sometimes where, particularly when I'm out in creation, where I just feel full. We have a little balcony on our flat. We're trying to sell it if anyone's interested, but just so you know. And it's beautiful, beautiful balcony. And even this morning, the sun rose on the horizon, and I could see it as it started to rise, and I just felt so thankful for it. And when you have those moments and your heart's full of thanks, you know that actually that only God is worthy of that thanks. There's no one else to thank for that. But that thanks is there nonetheless. And it doesn't matter in those moments whether anyone else hears that or not. That's for God's ears. But it's really easy, isn't it, particularly in the church, for worship to be about something else. And we're going to sing a song afterwards, and I'm called The Heart of Worship. And I often remember Matt Redman, who wrote that song, talking about it. And he was part of the start of the church called Soul Survivor, where Helen's going to be in 2 weeks' time, and Dave. And their son is, at the moment, doing a year of service there. And they started this church because they felt called to, out of these festivals they had in the summer, they started a festival called Soul Survivor, where thousands of young people gathered for a few days of teaching and worship. And worship really quickly became a hallmark of those festivals. It became what people gathered for. There was this hunger to worship God. And they were really good at it. And they started this church. And they had all these great musicians there and all these young people. And they thought, this is going to be fantastic. This is going to be such an incredible weekly service that we're going to have, because the festivals are brilliant in the summer and we've got these great musicians every week. And the story goes that they quickly found that their worship was just dry. They turn up week after week, and Mike Pelavacci, who led the church, and Matt Redman and others, they felt there was something completely missing. Something that they had in the summer, the festivals, that they just didn't have week by week. And so what they did was they made the decision to ban the band. And they said, right, what we're going to do is we're not going to have this, all this stuff. We're not going to have worship like this every week, because we've lost it. We've lost the point of what's going on. And so they gather week by week, and they just gather in a circle, no music. And they gather and they worship God without all that stuff. And it was out of that one week Matt Redman turned up with his guitar and he sat down and he said, I've written a song, which kind of shared where they were at. And it was this song, The Heart of Worship. And coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you, Jesus. I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it. And it's all about you, Jesus. And I think that worship that really calls out any kind of heart from us, any kind of response, is worship that's directed to the right place, to God. The third thing, and this is to do with David and his just undignified nature, saying, I'll become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. I think that worship deposes us from the throne of our lives. I know that for myself, left to my own devices, I very quickly become the center of my universe. My life very quickly becomes about me, about my comfort, my happiness, what I want to do, the way I think is right. And it's very easy for our egos and our own well-being, our own way of thinking, to be on the throne of our lives. And we can build little kingdoms and little protections for ourselves. And I think that's ultimately where sin comes from, when we put ourselves at the center. But what worship does, and what it does in this particular passage, is it subverts us. It kicks us off. It boots us off the throne of our lives. I'll be humiliated in my own eyes. It challenges the notion that we are at the center of the universe. And for David, worship in this passage, it overrode his own ego, and it was placing God back on the throne, which is what he was doing, bringing the ark back into Jerusalem, bringing the ark back to that central focal point of their communal life together. And so we're going to go back into worship in a moment. But as I finish, I just want to remind us of what we all already know, that worship is much more than singing songs. Much, much more. Which is great news if you don't like singing. A lot of people don't like singing. And yet we come to church and sometimes we say, this is worship. Worship is much more than singing songs. In fact, I think it's more than anything we do. It's more than what we do, isn't it? Worship's a heart response to God. It's a response that calls out generosity and foolishness out of us that people might not understand, and whether that's foolishness in what we do, what we give, how we serve. Foolishness nonetheless. And it's an act of relationship that's for God and reminds us of our place in the universe. And this morning I pray for myself and for all of us that we constantly find ourselves back at the heart of worship, where our hearts are engaged with the living God. Let's pray. Lord, for the times that we place ourselves at the centre of our world, of our universe. We say sorry, and we ask that you would take that place in our lives, the throne, if you like, of our lives, the driving seat. And as we come to worship you again this morning, and even as we leave here, as we worship you in our actions, in our deeds today, and pray that you would be at the centre of that, that our hearts would respond to you, not respond to just the songs or the words or whatever it might be, but we would see you in all things, and that would call out a response from us. We pray that it would be a living relationship with a living God at the heart of our worship. Make us a worshiping people, we pray.